Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast Archives, Film Directing. In this podcast, we go into our back catalog to find the best interviews, conversations, and episodes to help you understand the craft of film directing. And before we get started, I want to let you know that I've put together a free masterclass on directing action sequences on a low budget. All you need to do is head over to indiefilmhustle.com/free course to gain access to this free mini masterclass. That's indiefilmhustle.com/free course.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, my indie film hustlers, to the 100th episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I cannot believe we have made it this far, but as always, I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. And before we get into the show, guys, I just am blown away that I've been able to keep this up for 100 episodes. It's actually quite, I'm impressed with myself. And I wanted to thank you guys all for all the support and everything you guys have done for the show, for the website, and getting the word out on what we're trying to do at Indie Film Hustle, man. So thank you so much. I found this quote and I felt that it was a perfect example of what this podcast and what I have been preaching about for so long. It encompasses all of that. The most difficult thing in the world is to reveal yourself, to express what you have to. As an artist, I feel that we must try many things, but above all, we must dare to fail. You must be willing to risk everything to really express it all. John Cassavetes. Today's guest, the surprise mystery guest, his name is Aaron Kaufman. Now, for those who don't know who Aaron Kaufman is, Aaron Kaufman was the producer for Robert Rodriguez for over 7 years. And he produced the sequel to Sin City, both Machetes, worked on Spy Kids, and worked very closely with Robert for over the course of 7 years. And I grilled him about the process that Robert works on, how he got into the business, as well as he's an accomplished director himself, which he directed a movie called Urge, starring James Bond, Pierce Brosnan, which is a really cool flick as well. And then we later in the interview, we bring in Brian Levine, who is a producer on the new film Flock of Dudes, which also Aaron produced. Very cool indie movie done on a very low budget and also kind of done in a run and gun style that that we did on This Is Meg, probably at a little bit higher budget range than we worked with. But it was a really educational process. They explained their entire process and how they did it, how they got the movie made, with the, you know, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, if you guys are fans of Robert Rodriguez, you guys are going to love this episode. And I grilled Aaron, poor Aaron, I grilled him pretty hard about how it was to work with Robert, how they got together, and the whole process of making movies. And Aaron's been around for a while. So it's a really educational episode, guys. And I really wanted to bring something special for the 100th episode. So I hope you guys enjoy my interview with Aaron Kaufman and Brian Levine. I'd like to welcome to the show Aaron Kaufman, man. Thank you so much for reaching out to me, man. I'm excited to have you on the show.
Yeah, I really like your show. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, man. How'd you find, just out of morbid curiosity, how did you find out about me? Or like,
I don't know why it's morbid. But I actually really love that there's this sort of podcast community building. You know, I like John August's show with Craig Mazin's great. You know, obviously NPR does The Business, but if you look up, you know, if you Google like
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Film podcasts, you come up on those all the time.
So once
I started getting into those, I was like, oh, what else is out there? And that's kind of how I came across it.
Yeah, there's a lot of great filmmaking podcasts out there, and they're building more, getting more and more. There's a bunch more and more coming up every day. So it's just such a wealth of information. I mean, such a wealth of information.
which is great, because when I started, there was not.
There was nothing.
So, yeah, you would have to go to like the Dove, whatever that guy's name is.
Dove Simmons.
Dove Simmons. You have to go to like the Dove Simmons weekend course.
Two-day film school.
Yep.
And I actually had – Dove was my eighth guest. He was on show number eight, and he's still exactly the way you remember him.
I only remember a couple things. One, I remember I only went because I was told, and I don't know that this is true because I haven't been able to confirm it, mm-hmm. that Quentin Tarantino had gone to his
yes.
program.
Yeah, Will but Smith, I, Quentin Tarantino.
But I know Quentin Tarantino, and I've asked him about it, and he really didn't – I don't know that it's true. Like, he sort of looked at me confused, so I don't actually know that that's true. I don't know if we're breaking the story here. But
wow. That's been his big calling card for the last two decades.
It's possible, but I wasn't able to confirm it. And then, two, I'm trying to think of all the advice at the time. Mm-hmm. And the biggest piece of advice I remember Dove giving was that you got to treat your actors well. Yeah. So you should cut the bagels beforehand so the actors don't have to cut their own bagels.
That's actually quite great advice.
It's how I've gotten in the position I'm in today.
And and the other great – I had a great piece of advice from an old DP when I was on set once. And, you know, I was on an indie – it was like a small budget, you know, a music video or something. And the producer came out. Everyone was, what's for lunch? And the DP just turned to me and said, oh, my God, they're spinning wheels of death. Do you know what spinning wheels of death are?
No, is that what bagels are?
No, those are pizzas.
Oh, okay. Because there's no protein and it's all bread.
It's just all bread, and it just slows the crew down, and it's yep. and it's just cheap food, you know, generally speaking. So you'd never want to feed your crew
no,
pizza if you can help it. Maybe once in a blue moon, but if you can help it.
Craft service is my specialty, so that's all I'll know for.
So how did you get into the crazy world of filmmaking, man?
Well, I always wanted to. I mean, since I can remember, I don't really have other interests or other talents or anything like that. When I was young, you know, I was I guess 13, 14, and I wanted to. I think I saw Do the Right Thing when I was 14.
Great movie.
And I was like, you know, blown away because I didn't before that. I didn't really know what a director really did or was. I mean, I think Steven Spielberg is probably the only other director I was aware of. And mm-hmm. then what was cool was Spike Lee actually wrote these books. I don't know if you ever saw them or not.
No.
But they're great. In fact, I think they still are great. But what was cool about it is he kept these journals and he published them.
So like Robert did.
But it was before Robert. And actually I was surprised when I met Robert initially that he was a big fan of those books. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't know anybody else who would love them. But like She's Gotta Have It, School Days, and Do the Right Thing. And then I think he did them for a while. I think he did them all the way up to Malcolm X.
Oh wow.
But what was cool about him was he really kept a journal, and a lot of the questions I had, like what the fuck does a director do? He answered those himself, you know, or like, what is this? Or how do you do this? Or when do you do that? Or how much should this cost? And he literally has it in there. If you read the one for She's Gotta Have It, he literally rented a editing, you know, a flatbed and moved it into his studio apartment. And mm-hmm. he's writing about trying to figure out how to work it, you know? So he really started from that point. And because when you read film books normally from like we read the books of great directors, mm-hmm. it's always like I was born and then when I directed my first feature, yada, yada, yada. And you're like, whoa, what happened in between those right. two things? Like, you know, how did you make this movie for, you know, how did this happen? And so his was the first that I had read where he really got into the nitty gritty. And then from there, I was really off. But it took me a while. I spent a lot of my 20s doing other things. But when I was, I guess about 27 or so, I had my first job in entertainment, which was, I may be a little older. I think it was 28 maybe. But I started working for Chris Blackwell at Palm Pictures, which was the company he started after Island Records. And mm-hmm. that was my first exposure. And it was great because I got to touch, you know, everything from music to film. He was even doing some really early online stuff at the time. And so it was a great place to sort of start learning a lot about the business. And then from there, it's been step by step, you know, trying to produce and then eventually producing films and then eventually working with Robert Rodriguez and then directing and then talking to you.
So since you bring Robert up, and by the way, I'm just going to step back for a second. For all the kids in the audience, a flatbed is how you used to edit film, and that there's this thing called film that they used to shoot movies on. And if you guys haven't seen She's Gotta Have It, if I'm not mistaken, that's his first feature, right? Spikes?
That's his first, yeah.
Yeah, so She's Gotta Have It. It was kind of
It's still kind of great.
No, it's amazing. I remember seeing it in film school and then during that time, because it was She's Gotta Have It is one of – he was at that moment of time where – we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. All the independent – the big independent movement started right before Quentin and Mariachi and Clerks and Sex, Lies, and Videotape. It was all during those like late 80s, early 90s and the independent explosion. And yeah. Spike was right there with She's Gotta Have It. He's one of the first guys to come out the gate.
I saw that in high school. And then – because I think I saw Dude I Think first and then went back and saw his other movies.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I remember like hearing about the Sundance Film Festival for the first time when I was in maybe 11th grade and Steven Soderbergh. And then, you know, the whole Quentin Robert thing happened after that. And that was when – I mean, there was such a vitality to that time that it's almost a bummer now because, you know, that's the it's that time you're just not going to have another time like that, I think, in the foreseeable future.
It was like – it was basically like the 70s. Like, you'll never see a run of movies and directors explode like they did in the 70s. It was just a different time. You know, having Scorsese do Taxi Driver and Easy Rider and The Godfathers and Jaws and all these kinds of guys just blow up. Same thing happened for the 90s. That little early part of the 90s, late 80s, early 90s, that independent explosion came out.
Yeah.
It's something that I think there's going to be something like that again, but it'll be different. Like now, but I just – there's just so much now.
I thought in the sort of early mid 2000s, I thought that you would see it because there was that like Michel Gondry,
and the commercial guys,
Mark Romanek and those guys,
Fincher and all those guys,
and Chris Cunningham, who actually still not made a feature, but
didn't Chris Cunningham do Inspector Gadget? No, that's David Kellogg.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think Chris has still not made it, but he's done, like,
amazing. He's amazing. Yeah,
those great Bjork videos.
Oh God, amazing stuff.
And so that was sort of – I thought, you know, and I mean, obviously we got some, you know, Mark Romanek and those guys we got out of that time. But that's like the last sort of movement of any kind. And I think you could probably add Sofia and Roman Coppola to that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But there hasn't been, and I've always thought, even back then, because Palm Pictures owned a magazine called Res Magazine, which was started by a couple guys, a friend of mine named John Scalise, and they were really early to the digital world. You know, this was like back, really in 2000, 2001. And I really thought that the digital would bring in sort of a new wave, because now there's all these people that have a voice that can now make a film. I mean, I'm old enough to remember taking film courses at NYU that we had to, because we were dealing with film.
Short ends.
16 millimeter. Well, not only doing short ends, but where you would direct a shot and then you would move over and the next person would direct the next shot because you're dealing with the, you know, how expensive film is. Now it's like people can, you know, do stuff on their phones. I'm waiting for that crest and that wave of sort of new filmmakers, and I'm sure they're here, they're, you know, here in spots, but there hasn't been like a movement of brand new filmmakers to come out of that.
And I feel now, and now we're getting off a little bit off the subject, but I'll say this one thing and then we'll move on, because I feel that there is a lot of talent now, and you can see it, and there's these kids who've like – they're like, oh, I already made my first feature at 14. I'm like, you know, go screw yourself. No, I'm joking. Like, you and me are like, John, son of a, you know. And then
I love it.
Like, I know. I love it, too. I love it, too. But I'm like, I wish.
I just haven't. There's a lot of stuff being created. But I don't know that there's a lot of, you know, there isn't the voices, per se, to support it.
Right. And also, I think the other big aspect is, even if there is some good work out there, trying to break through the noise, you have to have a marketing degree. You have to have an audience. You have to have so many different things just to get noticed sometimes. It's so tough. It's really, really tough to break through, as opposed to the early 90s. Like Kevin Smith said, he's like, if I show up with Clerks today, I would never get – no one would even look at me.
And I say the same thing about the movie that is integral to me is Larry Clark's Kids.
Oh, I love Kids.
And I think about that because that was at that moment, especially in New York, everybody of my generation, like that's their American Graffiti.
I remember Kids.
I don't know what this says about our generation, but
yeah, I know, right? Sure.
But that movie today, it would be tough to get that movie a digital release, you know, like and getting any kind of real support around a digital release for it would be difficult.
It was difficult. It was difficult.
But then again, you have something like Sean Baker who did Tangerine. Mm-hmm. You know, that pops out and that's interesting. I'd love to see more stuff like that where you know you're seeing people use new technology in different ways.
Yeah, exactly. So let's get into the question you brought up, or you brought him up earlier today. You work with the legendary Robert Rodriguez. How did you get involved working with Robert?
I worked with Robert from, I guess, 2009 up until about 2015.
Okay.
Left to direct my first feature. But I had talked to Robert a few times, and I guess I had tried to pitch him projects, which when I got to work with him, I realized how futile those attempts were. You know, at the time it was like, cool, I'm trying to pitch Robert Rodriguez and maybe he'll do it. And then I realized working with him, like, oh wow, I never really had a chance. And mostly because he really generates so much of his work by himself. Mm-hmm. Which is what makes him super special. But eventually I kind of asked, you know, what was it that he wanted to do? You know, and he was in a bit of a transitional period after Grindhouse, but he still wanted to sort of explore that. You know, Grindhouse had met with sort of not the response that they were looking mm-hmm. for.
It was rough.
I think he still felt like, man, there's something there, and he just didn't want to, you know, kind of move on and admit defeat. And so we talked about Machete. He said, you know, I have this sort of 40-page outline of what I want to do, and I'd like to make it into a feature. And I immediately was like, great. Yeah. I mean, I knew Machete. I remember that was the first image that comes up on the, on Grindhouse. And it just I was in love immediately because it was just everything right. I had grown up with. And it was all distilled into this trailer, and it's kind of masterful. And, so I was in, you know, like a cult member.
Right. You drank the Kool-Aid. You
know, so I was like, whatever. Yeah. It was like, I'll do whatever I have to do to get this done. And it was, it had an interesting path where, you know, I went down to Austin and I got to see Troublemaker, which he had built, which was his own studio, which he had had from Spy Kids on, from like 2000, I think, or on. He had this studio, which was like a decommissioned airport mm-hmm. that they used to use for the governor. And he now had his own green screen and his own sound stages and a backlot
and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was for me, once I saw that, it was over. You know, I was like, I'll figure out how to move down here and work here, because there was just nothing. There's no equivalent. You know, mm-hmm. there's really few. I mean, maybe Peter Jackson and maybe George Lucas.
Right.
You know, as far as having your own fiefdom. But his was just outrageous, you know. And then. Also, I'm a real kind of old. I really love anything that's kind of old showbiz. Mm-hmm. And there was kind of, even though we were in Texas and it was 115 degrees or whatever it was down there, it had kind of an old show business feel to it. Because you had, you know, you had your costume department, and you had your, you know, this department, and you had makeup and hair, and everything was set up, and he had a staff on board, and all of his staff were like really. Film nerds, you know, they really were focused on the craft. And so it was just amazing. And we initially were going to put Machete together as a small sort of direct to video product. And I remember Robert really was like, look, the only thing that, you know, has to stay constant is Danny Trejo has to play Machete.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, you say, of course, but you know, there were other people that would have made this movie with him, and there's other people that would have financed this movie with him. But they were like, great, get Antonio Banderas to play Machete, and we'll give you $25 million.
Right.
And he really stuck to his guns and was like, no, Machete is Danny Trejo. Danny Trejo is Machete. There's just, you know, there's just no two ways about it. And I said, yeah. I mean, to me, I thought the same way, of course. So I remember, it was funny, when we first sat down and we were in Austin, I remember two things distinctly. One was we called Danny Trejo, and he was like, I'm going to call him and let him know, you know, because this is the first time Danny was ever the star of a movie.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. Right. He's always been the character actor.
Oh, yeah. And it's funny, interesting. I know people catch it. But if you go and look at Machete, what's interesting is we went through other movies that that Danny had done where he got killed by the main star. Mm-hmm. And he had been killed by Steven Seagal a number of times. You know, he gets killed in Heat, which he did with Robert De Niro. Yep. So we started going and populating the movie with people who had killed him in the past, and now flips the script.
That's brilliant. That's actually quite brilliant.
It's actually the only time Steven Seagal, little trivia, the only time Steven Seagal ever dies on screen is in Machete.
And
I remember that was a big deal on the set that day. But it was just cool. You know, he was top of the call sheet, and it was great. But Robert calls him, hunts him down, and I guess he was in Louisiana shooting something. Mm-hmm. And you know, we're like, great, we're going to do it. He was so excited. He was so great, which he is. He's actually just a really lovely guy. Mm-hmm. And he says, I asked him, I said, well, what are you shooting now? And all of a sudden he pauses and you hear him open the door to his trailer and yell out to somebody, what's the name of this movie? And the person tells him back whatever it was. I forget actually what it was, but then he comes back and tells me, and Robert and I are laughing. So I'm like, but Danny, you don't know the name of the movie that you're starring in? And he goes, man, I work. that was his answer. And he does. You know,
does he ever?
He does some good stuff, but he's a great guy. And so that was sort of the beginning. But what ended up happening was it had such a good vibe about it, the project, and people were so supportive of it, mm-hmm. that all of a sudden we're starting to get inbound calls from people saying, you know, I would do something on this movie, or I would, you know, come down, or I would do this. And Robert, really to his credit, created such an environment down there where it was really fun for people, you know. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like, hey, we're shooting this in Bulgaria, we're shooting this, whatever. It was like, come down to Austin. The way Robert shoots will get you shot out in 3, 4, or 5 days.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, and I know a lot of people always wonder about this. I know the answer, but I want you to kind of tell the audience, is how he's able to get this amazing cast. Like, he gets these amazing, like, A-listers to come in and do bit parts in his movies. And you look at Sin City or even Machete. How does he do it? So please explain it to the audience if you can.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the first answer is that, you know, they're fans of his work. And and I think that, you know, people look at his movies and they think, you know, there's, you know, I don't know that Johnny Depp's ever looked as cool as he has in Robert's movies. I don't know that Salma Hayek's ever looked as amazing as she's looked in his movies. So, you know, for people, it's not that if I were an actor, I would want him to do my poster. Like,
it's true.
He creates these iconic images, you know, but I think that's one level. And then I think the other thing is that he has created an environment down there where, you know, you're going down to Austin, which, you know, for a couple of days is really a great, fun place to be. He has this environment where you're not really being, you know, you're not being hassled in the way that you are. But he also creates this thing where, you know, it's, and I've tried to keep this with me, it's pretty down to earth. You know, he doesn't really like the whole hierarchy. You know, he likes when people hang out on set. He doesn't really love when people are just in their trailers the whole time. Mm-hmm. And he fosters that kind of environment where, you know, he's got easels set up with paints and stuff and an artist so that actors can be, you know, painting portraits and stuff while they're waiting instead of being back in their trailer. And it just creates like a really artistic and really creative environment. And that's when I really started to, I mean, of course I always knew the importance of the creative, but he really drilled into everybody that it was kind of the only thing that was important. You know, like it doesn't like being creative, being able to express yourself, even if you're not an expert, if you're not an expert painter, you're not an expert musician, but just the fact that you're taking your expression and putting it out there is going to make it interesting. That's a really interesting thing. And I think for creative people like actors, that's very attractive. And so looking for that opportunity, they'll come down. And then also organizationally, he really knows production very well. And so, and he knows editing very well, which I found was very interesting in the sense that he knew that, you know, he would know exactly what he needed from someone. Mm-hmm. So he didn't really need to shoot a whole lot outside of what he needed. You know, he'll stop somebody in the middle of something and say, okay, look, I'm cutting here. So just take it to here. And he knows in his head exactly where the cuts are. as he's shooting. And it makes it a lot easier and more efficient. So he can shoot somebody out in 3 or 4 days. And that's something I've seen him do quite a bit. So it's him, it's Austin, and it's also that, you know, they're not coming down for 10 weeks. They're coming down for, 4 days.
Right. Now, does producing a movie like Machete and Machete Kills, is it as crazy as it looks like on screen?
I would say no. Okay. In the sense of I walked into an environment down there which was pretty, they were a pretty well-oiled team to begin with. And then my philosophy on things, I'm not a yeller screamer kind of drama person. I like when things are pretty easy going. So you would actually be surprised on our set how quiet and how sort of efficient it is. We have a lot of fun and a lot of the stuff that we're doing is, we would get to go to, so there were days where I'd come to work on Monday and we were blowing something up, and then the next day, we're trying to figure out how to rig a scene where he's pulling someone's intestines out.
Yes. Repelling against
the wall. Your job is definitely not dull, but there really wasn't a lot of the set itself ran like a pretty well-oiled machine. And even actors that were, known to be difficult on other sets, they tended to be in a different mindset when they came down to work with us, because they kind of knew that there wasn't room for the shenanigans. So people were generally on their best behavior when they came down, and they enjoyed the process.
Now, let me ask you a question. How this is just a side tip, and of course you can't name names, but I'm sure you've worked with difficult actors in the past.
Yes.
What are some tips that you would give a director who happens to be dealing with a big personality, or who's just acting up, or just being a brat, or things like that on a set, especially when the personalities are big?
Well, it's a good question. It's not an easy question to answer, but I'll answer it this way. First and foremost, if you're a first time director and you're getting a chance to work with talent, even if they're the greatest people ever, but they're a big talent, it's intimidating. So there's a lot of that that's going on, and I would say the first thing to do with people that are difficult is to really take a beat before you react. Right? A, don't initially take it personally. Because that's what everybody does, where it's like, okay, well, I'm going to be offended and I hate him and now he hates me. And then this just develops into, terribleness. So I would say, take a beat and ask yourself, why is this happening? Right? Because there are a lot of times where you have an actor who doesn't feel comfortable, right? You have an actor who doesn't feel like he's getting enough direction. Mm-hmm. You have an actor who's self-conscious, who doesn't really feel confident about the scene. Mm-hmm. And I would say a good half of the time, that's where the sort of bad behavior is coming from, is that. And if you can address those things, you'll see that change. And that's something you have to learn. The other 50% of the time, you might just be dealing with people that are terrible, terrible people.
In Hollywood? Yeah, no.
It happens, right? And so if you take a beat and that's your deduction, the one thing you need to be able to do is you do have to maintain control. In a lot of ways, that's your job as a director is, just being at the helm and being able to say, okay, this is my set and this is how we're gonna do this. And so you do have to do that. My suggestion is that you wait for those moments and then you bring it out when you have to bring it out. Because it happens. You have an actress who won't get out of her trailer or takes too long and she's eating into your time. There are the times where you have to go to their trailer yourself and handle it. And that's something I would recommend is, there are a lot of ways to kind of avoid confrontation because you could have your AD do it or you could have somebody else do it. One of the best things to do is to try to handle it yourself at times because there's stuff that they'll pull with if you have somebody who's a problem person, there's stuff that they'll pull with, with other people on the set that they won't necessarily pull with the director.
Or the producer for that matter.
Yeah, my experience is with being the director has a lot more weight than being a producer. But
Now, did you ever hear the story of Frank Oz and Marlon Brando?
I have. It's actually one of my favorite. Where he said, "I'm not one of your Muppets." So you can't
Yeah, you can't wait for the audience. This Frank Oz, who's a really great director, and also the voice of Yoda, and also a voice of I think the Muppets. He was a puppeteer. Oh, yeah.
And he did Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which is one of the greatest.
Oh my god, he did. Yeah, I mean he's a really good director, and he was directing a movie called The Score, if I remember correctly. Yeah, that was the name.
Edward Norton,
Robert De Niro, and the late Marlon Brando, and Marlon would not allow him on set. He had to direct from his trailer, and the only way he would talk to him is if Robert De Niro would be the middle person.
Yeah,
and I guess because he was Marlon Brando, he got away with it. Like,
it's interesting. I'd always heard those stories, and then obviously the Island of Dr. Moreau stories were the most notorious, where he had like a ice bucket that he insisted on wearing in his head during one of the scenes, and all this other stuff. But what's interesting is if that documentary that guy Stephen Riley did, Listen to Me, Marlon.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
If you watch that, it's interesting because you get a real feel for Brando, that the torture, a lot of the bad behavior, quote unquote, that he was guilty of, a lot of it came from the fact that he was bored. You know, that a lot of times just the act was, he just wasn't finding enough to get him that excited, and two, that he was trying to bring something interesting. If you go back and watch The Island of Dr. Moreau, like if you watch the documentary about it, I forgot what that was called, but it just makes Marlon Brando look like a monster. Right? Then you go back and watch The Island of Dr. Moreau, and you go, hey, this is not a great movie, but what's great about it is everything weird that Marlon Brando is doing.
Right. He's trying to do something, basically. Yeah,
so I forgot exactly what where the rift started between him and Frank Oz, but obviously he got to a point where he was just like, you know, I don't trust this person, and he's going to be a monster. And he was of a mindset that he wasn't worried about getting work in the future. He wasn't worried about anything.
No, he's Marlon Brando. Right.
Yeah. So that's that. But yeah, the Muppet story is hysterical. But Frank Oz, to me, he's actually done a bunch of cool movies. And I've never met him, but I've heard he's a really nice guy.
Yeah, I mean, and he's, for God's sakes, he's the voice of Yoda. I mean, seriously. I mean, that alone gets you drinks wherever you go for the rest of your life, I think.
Really? That's good.
Yeah. So you also worked on another little film called Sin City, the sequel to Sin City with Robert. What was it like jumping into that seat? Because, I mean, Sin City was a game-changing movie. It was like, you know, it was iconic what Robert did with the first one. So to come back and do the second one, how did that feel, and how what some stories you could tell me?
Super scary. it was really scary. I mean, I when I started working with him, obviously I was a big fan of really all of his work, really everything Robert had done, including the Spy Kids movies, and but obviously Sin City was, you know, just such a landmark movie, and the idea of getting back into that world and continuing the stories, because I was a big fan of the comics. In fact, that was one of our first conversations that kind of hit it off between Robert and I, were not about Frank Miller, but about Frank Frazetta. And those conversations where I told him what a big fan I was, and we started talking about that. I think he cared way more about that than any knowledge that I might have had about film or filmmaking. I was a huge Frank Miller fan, and the idea of going back and some of the other stories that I knew had been written and not published, to bring those make those a movie out of those, was just so interesting. I wanted to make it. I won't get into the vagaries of it all, but just the rights and getting it to just the point where we could make that movie.
Really?
There's probably a book in there, because they had done it originally with Miramax.
Right.
Miramax was owned by Disney at the time.
Yep.
And then the Weinsteins had left to start the Weinstein Company. And then Disney hadn't renewed the rights. And so at some point, and then Frank Miller had, claims on the rights. So at one point there was like five different entities from the new Miramax, the new Weinstein Company, Disney, Frank Miller, a couple other guys that essentially all challenged the rights and said, you know, we own those. So just cleaning that up took about a year.
And it was
to the point where every once in a while, Robert would say, maybe it's not meant to be, you know? And so Between the two of us, though, it was like, no, we have to do this. We have to get it made. And then so that we did that. And then ultimately, what people don't necessarily realize is Sin City 2, we made that independently. Like, it was released by the Weinsteins, mm-hmm. but we actually put that together as a pretty large independent movie.
You mean – so you guys – you mean Robert financed it himself?
No, he didn't. But he helped to finance it. He helped to put it together. Robert's actually – outside of the filmmaker credit that I give him, he actually picked up the film finance and sort of the business side of things, mm-hmm. and he picked a lot of that up very quickly, and he would get involved. So he and I actually put it together piece by piece, from equity to foreign sales to debt, etc. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of people that ended up working on getting that made, but it was a pretty crazy achievement even before cameras rolled on the movie. Then as far as the creative goes, getting that script to a point where, it was going to make fans, there was such the fan involvement was something I was not really familiar with. Mm-hmm. I did Comic-Con for the first time with Machete.
And then that's a circus and a half, isn't it?
Oh man. In some ways it's great. And in some ways it's super scary because we did a Hall H presentation.
Oh God.
Yeah. It's like 7,000 people.
And yeah.
That was where Robert announced that, if we ever did a third Machete, it would be Machete in space.
Yes.
And that was like, I remember just like 5,000 phones and Twitter accounts, like lighting up, immediately. But anyway, so, I was not aware of that prior. Robert was. Robert really knows the fans, and he himself is really kind of like a super fan when it comes to that world. I have that background, and that's interesting to me, mm-hmm. but I'm not as sort of into the vitality of what a comic book fan today is really looking for. Robert knows because he is that guy. And so he would tell me like, oh, they're not going to like this. Oh, they're not going to like that. Oh, they're going to go crazy over this. It was good that he had that kind of feel for it, cause I didn't. Mm-hmm. There were times, cause you're trying to put this cast together, and there were times where the producer side of me was like, all right, well, we can't get this person, or this person's not available. What do you think about this person? Mm-hmm. And he would look at me like, no, that's not going to work. You can't replace, this character, or that character, because the fans will go nuts.
Yeah. He's right.
So he was totally right. And so it was a lot of pressure from all sides to get that done. But the actual making of that movie, went pretty flawlessly. We did a lot, basically all of it green screened out in Austin. Mm-hmm. And, the production was actually a fun shoot to shoot.
And the one of the things I said, at least from the behind the scenes and all the things I've read about Sin City, is that the reason he was able to get people in and out is because he shot everything green screen. So sometimes, Marv would be having a conversation with Jessica Alba, and neither of them were in the room. Like, right. One of them was in the room, the other one wasn't, and so on and so forth. And he would just composite them later.
It happens. I mean, if you look at the first movie, there's the bar scene, which I think there's like a DVD extra. I don't mm-hmm. know if people watch DVD extras anymore, but.
What is this DVD you speak of?
Yeah, exactly. But there's DVD extra. Well, it'll show the bar scene, which basically has everybody. I mean, it's Mickey Rourke, Clive Owen, Bruce Willis, mm-hmm. Jessica Alba, and they're all in that one long bar scene. And I don't think any of them were in the room with each other at the same time.
Yeah, no, it was pretty. Like, I still remember when I saw Sin City, and my mouth just dropped, because it was at the time when I was making my first film. And it inspired me so much. It was just like, well, Robert in general, it's been one of my big inspirations. But that movie, it's just like no one has ever seen anything like that. And how amazing is it that in today's day and age, and with Sin City 1, I think was only about 10, 11 years ago that came out, that you can create something that no one has ever seen before. He literally created a real black and white movie. Like, not a black and gray.
Think about it. There's a lot of stuff in that movie where if you were pitching it, mm-hmm. there are a lot of objections to why that movie would not work. Right. It's black and white.
Oh.
It's an anthology film. It's a noir.
Yes.
It's super violent.
Super violent. Yeah.
So there's a lot of reasons why that didn't work, but why it did work was people just had never experienced anything like that before. And I think that, I'm definitely partial, but when I look at a lot of the sort of green screen movies that have made since, mm-hmm. I don't know that any have really been able to go back and replicate the pure joy that it was seeing that movie for the first time.
Well, I know Frank Miller was very vocal in saying that Zack Snyder had a lot to owe Robert for 300.
I think Zack Snyder would probably say that as well.
Because it's just like, I mean, seriously, I mean, 300, I mean, and we can get, I don't want to get off on the tangent on Zack, but 300 was also one of those movies that you, Jesus, I've never seen anything like that. But I think the thing that broke that door open was Sin City. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. And Robert, sure. Robert broke that door open.
For sure. In fact, I think that I believe Warner Brothers came down and actually checked out, like kicked the tires to sort of get get a feel for how he did it. Because there was actually a certain amount of, I don't think people understand this part, is there was a certain amount of R&D that Robert did prior, before he even went to go see Frank Miller. There was a R&D that he did just to see could it do this.
Right. He actually had a pitch video that he put together to convince Frank, because Frank said absolutely not. A million times.
Yeah, I think Frank had a bad experience with was it RoboCop 2?
RoboCop 2.
And he was like, fuck Hollywood. You
know, I'm out of here. I don't want to deal with Hollywood.
Exactly.
And I was actually in the Hall H when Grindhouse was being announced.
Oh wow.
That was because Grindhouse, I mean, God, I love Grindhouse. But I was like, when I saw it in the theater, I was one of the few people that did see it.
Yeah, I think I went to a midnight showing of it when the Thursday before the Friday it came out. I mean, I could not have been more excited for a movie than that.
And you were around when he was producing Predators as well, right?
Yeah, well, that was kind of cool because when I said like as far as the old showbiz kind of quality of Troublemaker was, when we were doing Machete, Predators was getting produced at the same time. And so we had almost like a backlot going in Troublemaker, where we'd walk, we'd be walking one way, and you'd see, Danny dressed up as Machete with like a severed head, and then the other way you would see, guys dressed up as Predators walking the other way,
having coughing and smoking a cigarette, right?
Yeah. And so like old like Roger Corman days, I was in hog heaven, like I was like, it doesn't get any better than this.
Yeah, that was a fun film as well. That was such a fun film to watch, Predators. So then so after you've got this, I'm obviously you learned a heck of a lot working with Robert in that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the period that was before my working with Robert, I learned a lot coming from New York, coming mm-hmm. from that indie world. Mm-hmm. You learn a lot of how to kind of be scrappy and where mm-hmm. to find money and mm-hmm. how to put projects together and those things. And I'm happy that I had that first mm-hmm. Because it really taught you to sort of not take no for an answer and how to get something made. The next phase working with Robert really taught me the value of the creative and sort of how movies can get made on a broader, bigger scale, but also using that same kind of mentality. Because we would try to always make a movie for less than what we had available to us. We'd always try to, if we could get, 40 million, we'd make it for 30, just because it gave us the flexibility to make what we wanted. And so that was, sort of what I learned in that phase. And then just pure production, because we were making a movie every 9 months when I was there. And so you're just constantly in production, and is really better than any kind of school I could have gone to.
Yeah, I remember when Spy Kids was. I mean, Spy Kids kind of like launched Robert. I think financially, it's his biggest thing, right? Still to this day, I think the Spy Kids trilogy. Right?
Yeah, I mean, they're talking huge. Yeah, huge, I mean, they were all pretty huge successes.
They were huge successes. I remember when the first one. I think the Weinsteins gave him like $20 million or something like that to make the first one. And then when the
I mean, if you look at them, the amount of visual effects, the amount of—
Oh, no, it's insane. But my point was, like, on the second one, they were like, here, we won't give you more money. Robert was like, nope, yeah. I'll do it for the same. And that was—
He knew the value, and it's something that I try to remember. I don't always remember, but it's true. But he knew the value of leave me alone, and I will make something dope. Yep. And if you look at Sin City, something that different, that weird, that original, if he had made that movie for $120 million,
oh, forget
there's,
it.
Yeah, there's no way, because no way. You just, with that much to lose, you'd have people just crawling all over you, second guessing, should it really be in black and white? Does the whole thing need to be in black and white? Can we do this? Can we do that? Could these YouTube influencers be the star?
Whatever. So with that said, because you bring up a very good point. What is your whole take on this whole YouTube influencers or social media stars going into traditional media, where many times they might be a hit in their medium, which is making funny YouTube videos or doing things like that. But when they try to translate that into another platform that they're just, you know, they're not actors. They're not, they don't have those skill sets. They don't have those kind of things. I see a lot of that happening lately. I think Hollywood's starting to get burned a lot from it. What's your opinion on it?
I mean, you can't fault them for trying, right?
Of course.
They're looking and saying, okay, this person's able to draw, you know, people to watch whatever they're doing 40 million times. That, you know, just logically, that should probably translate, you know, to the theater. Mm-hmm. I personally think that all of this could be good. It's fine. But it's not predictive, because it doesn't really have anything to do with the quality of a film. You know, you could have somebody who's super famous. You know, Kim Kardashian's super famous. Mm-hmm. But if you put her in a starring role in a movie, it doesn't mean you'd have a successful movie.
It would be Glitter.
Or whatever. What was Pamela Anderson's movie? Barbed Wire. You know, I mean,
I think Barbed Wire was actually a little bit better than Glitter, I'm going to say. I'm gonna go out on a limb here.
Let's just spend the rest of this time just debating the Barbed Wire versus Glitter.
Versus Geely.
Versus Geely. But you know what I'm saying. So that's the issue, is whenever you've seen that, where you're basically just exploitative of someone's fame, it doesn't really translate, because they're different things. You know, what I want to, if I'm somebody who will watch a reality show, that doesn't mean I'm going to spend, you know, my money on a Friday to go see that person in a movie. I still want to know I'm going to get a good story. I'm going to get a good movie. Someone like Tom Cruise, people go, oh, I know that, you know, that's going to be this kind of movie that I enjoy. I'm going to go see it. And that's why he's able to draw people to a theater. So I think that all of this stuff potentially could be good. Mm-hmm. You know, technology could potentially be great. But at the end of the day, they have to have the goods. You know, it's a matter of, you know, them being able to do it. If you look at the 70s and, you know, Coppola and Friedkin and, you know, those guys were taking advantage of some certain technology as well at the time. Mm-hmm. But they were translating it into you know, masterpieces. I think that's what you need to see. Now, I would look more at a movie like Bellflower. I don't know if you remember that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Evan Goodell, like, those are guys who, they took not a lot of money, and they, you know, it took a long time to make that movie. And it's not by no means a masterpiece, but it was interesting and it was different. And I think that's what people have an opportunity to do now, is, you know, you've got a studio with your computer and your phone, and, you know, if you have a camera, you know, you have your own studio. So don't try to do what a studio already does, because you're never going to do it as good as they do.
I've said that.
So that's why Bellflower was cool to me, because it was like, oh, they're not trying to replicate and I realized that kind of an old, it came out, you know, 5-6 years ago, but that was one of the few movies where I saw it. I think Tangerine is an example of it as well, mm-hmm. where I was like, okay, they're actually using new technology. They're actually using the lack of resources to create their own aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting, and that will get people's attention. And I think that adds to, you know, that creates something worthwhile. What I see a lot of times is people that use technology to sort of just make shoddier versions of what you're used to seeing, and who wants to see that?
Right. And I think that's what a lot of people make mistakes in independent film, is they try to, and I was one of them. I was trying to compete with a $200 million movie. And you're just not. You can't get the star power. You can't get the technical stuff. And it's just, like you said, a shoddier version of what they're doing better, not story wise, but just technically. And I think that's where a lot of independent filmmakers kind of fall flat. And the ones that do break out, like a Napoleon Dynamite, like a Tangerine, they just do them very well. They do what they're trying to do very well, and they stay within the world that they're capable of doing, like a Bottle Rocket or, you know, any of those kind of movies. They didn't try to be something else that they're not. They tried to be who they were.
Yeah. And if you go back to, we were talking about the 90s before, you can look at Richard Linklater.
Slacker.
Slacker, right? It's like, that's cool. And that was its own movie. And it almost used the rawness of it to do it. But at the end of the day, he had a lot to say. And there was really interesting stuff there. Mariachi, you know, again, super rudimentary. And it wasn't about the quality per se, but he had a style, he had a something to put out there. So so I think that's where I look at the world, and I think to myself that it's almost a shame that we don't have, you know, where are our next five Scorsese's? You know, I'm sure they're out there somewhere, and they have the ability now to get our attention in a way that a Scorsese didn't.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, and real quick, I want to ask you on a side note, what do you think about like this summer's blockbuster movie performances and the state of where we are with the studios and the tent poles and all that kind of stuff? Because this summer was pretty meh.
it was. I have to say though, in full disclosure,
we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I do find myself, I'm in my 40s now, and I do find myself a little, I sound like an old dude these days, because all I do is complain about, the fact that, you know, they don't make them that way anymore. I'm living in New York now, and and they just opened up a theater called the Metrograph in Lower East Side, and they only project film. And it's this kind of glorious place. I mean, there's like a bookstore and a restaurant.
The
screens and the theaters are great. Yeah, it's super cool. But why I'm bringing it up is they did a De Palma retrospective this summer, and so I kept going back like a junkie. I mean, I was like, I couldn't.
Can you imagine just going and doing a retrospective of De Palma's work and film in a theater?
They did every film, and just seeing, you know, even Phantom of the Paradise and Dressed to Kill, and just seeing it, you know, fluttering in beautiful 35mm.
Yeah.
I literally could not, like, anytime I had some time and I could do it, I was going back to it. That's all I wanted to do. And then I went to see, right around the time I was seeing all these movies again, I went to see Warcraft with my son.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. You know, and look, the truth is, you know, Warcraft, it's not terrible. You know, there's some good performances in it. You know, it's not barbed wire. It's not chilly, you know. But at the same time, I was like, you know, this is what it's become. It's almost become something like what I think of film and what film is are almost two different things right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because this does not resemble, like, this is not why I got into this business.
Right.
It's just not. You know, it's loud, it's noisy. It's somewhat predictable. They are trying to top each other. They're trying to make almost like roller coaster rides more than they're trying to make films. It really has more to do with that kind of experience than it has anything to do with the Brian De Palma movies that I was going to see. So some people would say that television is really sucking up the need that people have, and that's why sort of indie film is not doing what it was. And you know what? There's probably some truth to that. But I will say I'm a grumpy old man, and I definitely miss the that feeling and excitement of sitting in the theater and having something blow your mind.
So after you worked with Robert, you decide to venture off into uncharted territory and direct your first film, which your first film was called Urge, starring James Bond himself, Pierce Brosnan.
the greatest. Yeah.
How did you? Arguably, he's one of the. He's on my top two or three. Top two, I would say. Top two. What was it like working with Pierce and working with a legend like that?
Well, I produced a movie. I worked with Leonard Howell on a movie called The Greatest a few years prior that he did with Susan Sarandon, it was this really kind of special movie, and he gave just an amazing performance. And I had always remembered that he was. In addition to being great, that he was just like super nice and humble and approachable. And he was working with our first time filmmaker on that movie.
Really?
And I remember being on set, and he was just super, just really great with her and really was trying to give a good performance and really thoughtful. And so when I went to make my first feature and I had built this role, sort of, this shadowy character, similar to like De Niro in Angel Heart, but I wanted someone who could kind of bring a textured performance to it. You know, I needed somebody who wasn't just going to like chew on the scenery, but was going to, because there was a lot of sort of texture to that character that who was just called the man in the movie, that I needed someone who that, and also we were sort of playing with, you know, is this person was a shadowy character that, you know, could be somebody, you know, is this the devil? Is this God? Is this, you know, there was an element of that there. And so I needed someone who had sort of like a otherworldly affect. And so he just came to mind, and it was that plus the fact of I knew that, you know, he would he'd be great to work with. Called him up and sent him the script, and you know, it's always nerve-wracking, but he read the script and he had a lot of notes and a lot of thoughts. And we talked for a while. We met to talk about it as well. And then he came and did it. And I was surprised. It was a little bit of a departure for him. Mm-hmm. And I think the first day on set, because the movie's kind of a crazy movie, and we mm-hmm. had, you know, albinos and we had little people and we had, you know, all this little stuff happening in this one scene. And I think he walked in and was like, whoa, what is this movie?
What did I sign up for?
What is this movie? By the second day, he was like, okay, we need this, we need that. And by the third day, he was just in hog heaven and had like a lot of fun. So he was really great to work with. And then, you know, it's just by itself, it's intimidating to try to give direction to somebody like that, because you've seen them before. They're so great. You know, they've been on set longer than you have. But when I gave direction, he was super supportive and collaborative. He had a lot of ideas. A lot of the smoking stuff and the sunglasses and a lot of the characters' gear, he had a lot to input for that. And then after that, you kind of sit back and let him do his thing, which if I wrote this screenplay with Jason Zumwalt and Jerry Stahl. Mm-hmm. And to hear someone like him read your or, you know, do perform your dialogue, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you sound like such a much better writer. I definitely would say my recommendation is have somebody awesome do your movie, because you sound like a much better writer once they get going.
Exactly. Is that the secret to Quentin's success? No, I'm joking. No. I think anybody.
I had obviously way more interaction with Robert, uh-huh. but the interactions I've had with Quentin, he always has good advice. He always has a great kind of point of view. You know within 5 minutes talking to Quentin why Quentin's Quentin. You know, like, for instance, even writing, he'll tell you, like, you know those scenes that, like, when the guy's got to get the key to go get in the car, whatever. Yeah, don't write that scene. Like, if it can't be great, don't write it. So, like, put the guy in the car. People will figure out, you know, that how he got there. And the little tidbits like that.
That's a great piece of advice, actually.
It's great. You know, it's like, as we're writing, I'm like, well, is this scene connective tissue? Do we really need it? You know, is this scene awesome? And a lot of how I write now, I kind of always have that voice in the back of my head.
I
worked with Sidney Lumet before he died.
Oh, my and, gosh.
Yeah, I spent a good amount of time with him working on a project that sadly never was able to be made, mm-hmm. because he passed away. But he was kind of awesome at giving you little crumbs of advice that at the time I don't know that I appreciated. But when I was directing, it all came back to me. I was like, oh, right. He told me this.
What was the name? What was his name of that book that he wrote? Is it Making Movies?
It was Making Movies, I think.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great. I mean, anybody who has not, if you're being a director, you've got to read that book. I read that book years ago. It's such an amazing, amazing book on directing and filmmaking. And the thing is that when you were reading it, he was nervous. He was insecure. You know, he's Sidney frickin' Lumet, man.
What's great about Making Movies is, like I was saying before about Spike Lee, is and there's actually a lot of analogs between the two of them. But that book actually gives you functional information. He doesn't say like, yeah, so, you know, get a great actor to do your movie and then blah, blah, blah. He gives you like literally, you know, you should eat lunch later in the day so you have energy to finish out your day. You know, he gives these kind of cute little anecdotes in addition to his other, you know, writings to really, you know, help you to direct. But yeah, he was amazing. And he would tell you things like that background can kill a scene. So always make sure that your background looks natural. So he used to, back in the day, he would walk up, if he had a crowded scene of like 30 people walking by in the mm-hmm, background, mm-hmm. he would walk up to each one and give them what he would call a little bit of business. So he'd walk up and be like, hey, so you just got divorced today. and you just found out you have herpes and you are on your way to lunch and you're super hungry. And he would do this so that they all had some kind of motivation. And if you go back and watch his movies, the background's always flawless.
That's a great piece of advice, actually. Yeah, it's Can you imagine as an extra having Sidney LeBent come over to you and give you some business?
Be awesome.
So what was the biggest lesson you learned directing Urge?
Well, directing Urge, I really enjoyed directing Urge. And I kind of had that my first day on set. I had this kind of exhilarating and also scary feeling all at once, which was, you know, I...
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
Was like, wow, this is what I want to do. Like, this is it. You know, and you don't really know that until you do it your first day. And so that was the first. And then second from that was, you know, that... you can't go back, you know? So it's like you get almost nervous, like, okay, I got to keep this going because this is the greatest high that there is. But directing, you know, really is, I learned a lot of listening to your crew. You know, I had good crew. I had people that told me things that, that really were, you know, if you listen to them, there are people there that want to help you. And you also realize that you're dealing with a cult of personality. And so trying to, trying to work with a crew, you can get the best out of them by really including them. And if you include them and they feel part of the process, they'll give you your best. But you can also work the other way, where you're kind of shutting them out and they stop caring about the movie as much. So you almost have to be a little bit of a cult leader to get everybody psyched about the movie and everybody focused in the same direction. And then from there to really listen to them. I mean, I had an AD on Urge named Sherry, who was great. And she told me, you know, look, there are going to be days where you get to set where everything you've asked for is not going to be the way you want it. Mm-hmm. And you have to be able to roll with that. And at the time I was like, wow, she's being super negative because, you know, I've told everybody what I want. So why would they bring me something I don't want? And then the first day on set where I had asked for something and gotten something completely different, I wasn't shocked because I had been prepared for that. And that a lot of times are little things, but those little things add up and that's it. You're like the conductor and you're playing the crew in many ways.
Now, what do you like better, directing or producing?
For me, there's no comparison. I will always produce because it's what I know how to do. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, directing, you realize, like I realized myself, that as a producer, you're doing all the hard stuff. You know, you're doing all the stuff that nobody wants to do. And then you're handing off all the cool things to a director. So that's sort of my feeling on it. But I also like producing, and producing is sort of a different muscle. Mm-hmm. And I love to work with, you know, people that I think are great, you know, director wise. And I think I've done it long enough now where I like to be able to take all my battle scars and help somebody not have to necessarily, you know, experience the same.
So we're back, guys, and I want to welcome to the show Brian Levine. Okay. Mm-hmm. Just call you Bri. No, I'm joking. Welcome Bri to the show. And Aaron is still here, and we're going to talk about their new, very funny looking movie called Flock of Dudes. So, Brian, Aaron, first tell me how you met Brian and how did you get involved with this crazy group?
Well, to name drop a little bit, I was introduced to him by Danny Masterson, who's a mutual friend of ours. Danny was in Urge as well. And we love Danny. And he had done a pilot with these guys and said, you know, you got to meet them. They're super funny. And he had a good experience with them. And he introduced us. And Brian and I started to talk. And eventually, when they had a rough cut of the pilot they had done together for Comedy Central, they asked me to see it. I took a look at it, and I liked it a lot. It was very funny. And we continued to talk. And later on, when Robert was working on Spy Kids 4, we needed some help script-wise, just doing some punch-up and adding some jokes. We had Bob Weinstein calling, you know, almost daily saying, you know, come on, man, you need more jokes. And so,
that's a great impression of Hardy, by the way. It's very good. Working on a
few. But I brought up, I was like, you know, I know these guys called the Post Show that I met, and I saw their pilot, and they're really funny guys. What about bringing them down? And so Robert brought them down to Austin, and in like 2 days, they wrote like 1,000 jokes, and Robert immediately liked them, which was not something I was expecting. I mean, not that I don't love them as well, but he just took a liking to them immediately and actually gave them small bit parts in the movie. And that went well. And Brian and I had been friends for a while at that point. And they had a movie that, they had sold to Lionsgate, which I'm sure someone to talk about, that they had a turnaround that they wanted to make. And we ultimately started working together.
So Brian, real quick, how the hell was that phone call when he goes, hey, do you want to come down to Austin and work with Robert Rodriguez on something, do a little writing for him? How was that? How did you handle that?
Well, it was kind of, from what I remember, it was kind of quick. It was kind of like, hey, we need you, and we need you like tomorrow. Can you get on a plane? So it kind of wasn't really that much time to process it. It was just like, okay, yeah, obviously we'll be down there as soon as possible.
And how was it working on Spy Kids 4 and that whole experience?
It's great. I mean, you know, they have such an interesting setup they have down there with the studio and so many resources that they have. And obviously, you know, watching Robert operate and everything was really interesting.
Very cool. Now, Brian, where did you get your start? Aaron told me a little bit, you have a show on YouTube, I think you started.
Yeah, so we started it was about 10 years ago. Me and Bob and Jason, the other guys, comedians from New York, we started putting up videos online. This was actually before YouTube, oddly enough. And
what were you putting them up on then?
We were just we put up a website, and we just kind of said we're just going to put up 2 videos a week.
Okay,
and we're going to have a TV show on the internet, which was a new concept in 2005.
Yes, it was.
And that's basically what we did. And then YouTube came along about kind of like while we were doing that. And that kind of shifted the dynamics. But at that point, word had kind of gotten out to certain people in New York about our show. And we ended up doing a deal with Super Deluxe, which was an online comedy website that was part of Adult Swim.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very cool. And then you met Aaron, and then you guys got a deal with Lionsgate. What was the deal with Lionsgate that you did?
Yeah, and so then Bob and Jason and I moved out to Los Angeles, and we had written a script, Flock of Dudes, and teamed up with we signed with United Talent Agency, mm-hmm. and through them, they introduced us to Imagine Entertainment,
mm-hmm.
and we developed Flock of Dudes, the script that we had with them, and then eventually we went out to the town with it, and Lionsgate ended up buying it, and that began a process of developing it with Lionsgate for about a year or so.
And how is the development process?
Well, you know, I've only kind of been through it in that way with a studio, mm-hmm. Just that one time. So I can't say what it's like always. You know, it's kind of what you would expect, I think, and what you've heard, which is there are a lot of other people involved. There's a lot of other opinions, and it's not just 3 guys writing at a cafe anymore. It's, you know, people who are looking at this through the lens of, at the studio level, a $30-50 million investment. And that kind of changes the creative process.
So you obviously, I'm assuming that the Flock of Dudes that has been produced was not produced at a $30-50 million budget.
No, it wasn't.
Okay.
No, it was not 30 or 50.
Not 30 or 50?
No, but what's funny was we were kind of, I was putting it together with Ryan from Austin while I was still doing Sin City.
Mm-hmm.
And so there I had, you know, this kind of $70 million behemoth. and then I'm trying to put this this smaller movie together in LA. But actually it was kind of fun to do it. You know, it's like after working on something so big and so much of an octopus, doing something that we kind of had total control over was a lot of fun. And even the problem solving of like, okay, we just, you know, we want to push this, we want to make it look as close to a studio comedy as possible, but we just don't have those kind of funds. The problem solving or figuring out how to do it really was kind of interesting. And I think the movie benefited from that. We also had some other good people that really liked the project a lot and got involved. And so I think what you see there is really not reflective of what the actual hard dollar cost of the movie was.
So then you were at the studio with Flock of Dudes, and obviously the studio didn't do the movie. So what happened? How did that translate to where you are today with the movie?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah, so the rights came back to me, and Aaron and I started discussing the script because I think I still felt like it was a good movie that had a lot of appeal, and Aaron read it and he liked it, and that began kind of the process of us trying to figure out how to put it together outside of a studio financing it.
Okay, and then you did it. Go ahead. Aaron?
But I had never made a comedy. I mean, I had never made a comedy intentionally before.
Touche.
Yeah. And so it was actually, that was interesting as well, you know, because I was coming at it from my perspective, which was like, you know, hey, there's, you know, we don't have any machetes in this movie and there's nobody getting their head cut off. So like we have to really make these scenes pop because we don't have the same stuff that our go-to, you know, our go-to stuff we don't have. And so just grinding with Brian and his partners really was kind of fun, and then shooting it was a lot different because you had these guys that were just ad-libbing so much that it became like, you know, part of the producing job was just trying to get them to shut up every once in a while because they were coming up with great stuff, but it was just, you know, we had an indie movie schedule and had to just get what we had to get in and move on. So coming up with sort of a workflow that would allow them to still, you know, ad lib and come up with stuff at the same time, you know, getting a good shot. We had to learn that on set.
And how long was the production schedule on it?
I think we were 21 days. Does that sound right, Brian?
Yeah, something like that.
About 21 days. And I'm going to geek out a little bit. What did you guys shoot the camera? What camera did you shoot with?
We showed Ari Alexa.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks really good. It looks really great.
I've used the Red as well, but I like Ari. Ari, we get kind of a more of a cinematic feel. I feel.
Yeah, I know. Then that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
It's like Mac versus PC. I mean, it's a very big conversation. So how did you guys get such a cool cast? I mean, I was watching the trailer, I was like, Jesus, he's in it, and he's in it, she's in it. It's like, how did you get this such a great cast to be put together on I'm assuming under $30 million budget?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the cast was kind of through relationships that all of us had, just being in kind of the comedy world for a while or being kind of in the film world for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you get kind of a momentum going and other people kind of see that a lot of cool people are doing it and they want to join. And then also UTA was very helpful with us in terms of getting the ball rolling with some really cool cast. And yeah, I think everybody just kind of tried to pull a couple people in. And before you knew it, we had, you know, about 15 or 20 people who were really some of the most talented guys in comedy.
Now,
and women as well.
Now, how is it like, and Aaron, you kind of touched upon this, when you have a group of comics and comedic actors who are doing a lot of ad-libbing, especially in these larger scenes, how the hell do you corral them? How the hell do you direct them?
Like, it's, you know, we had a first-time filmmaker as well, so it was I didn't envy him. Mm-hmm. Because he would have to sort of, you know, become the lion tamer, because you have these some of these guys like Brett Gelman and Eric Andre are just like monster ad-libbers and improv guys, and so it was, I think it was tough for him. But we had to sort of explain to people what our, you know, what our situation was, and also create a space for them where they felt comfortable to you know, express creativity, but in kind of a guideline to still get the movie made. But I'm really happy with the movie. I mean, I think too, when we made it a little while ago, and that now we look like geniuses because most of the cast have gone on to become huge. You know, you have Kumail Nanjiani and Hannibal Buress, who's, you know, obviously has just really blown up. Chris D'Elia, you know, had Undateable, and his stand-up specials have become huge. And, you know, and as well as Hilary Duff and Ray Liotta and people like that who had done the movie with us. So it's been interesting to see that happen, and now the movie looks a lot bigger because it's got this great and huge cast.
How was it working with Henry Hill?
Well, he was in Sin City too as well.
Yeah,
and actually I really like him a lot. He's, you know, he's obviously a great actor, but he's somebody who will like on Sin City he'll hang out on set and tell funny stories and you know, really be kind of a good dude. He's intense, but he's he's that kind of guy, you know, where he'll even on Flock, actually he hung out when he wasn't shooting a little bit, and we were just, you know, chatting up. So he's always been a good guy, and he was great to do a day on Flock, which he didn't have to do.
Now, what advice would you give someone trying to produce a film in the indie world in today's world?
Run.
Brian, would you agree?
Well, it's, you know, it's interesting. It's where to start with that question?
I think we touched on it before, you know, in the sense of, I think that you have to really get a feel for what the world looks like, you know, and I think that if you want to make something that's really different and really, you know, really out of the ordinary, that is what I think will get people's attention. And maybe that you have to really be smart about it and lower your budget and try to be as clever as you can to get something out there. I would say in general, don't try to make something that the studios are making. Really look at like what you can do and you can do with the resources you have. A lot of it, like I said, goes back to El Mariachi. You know, it was like he had these things. He's going to make his movie around those things. I think it's still good advice. And making something smaller that you can control, that you can make great, is probably better than, you know, just trying to make a yet another of that same kind of Sundance movie that doesn't really have an audience in the way that it used to.
And where can people see the film?
So the film comes out September 30th. The guys at Stars are our partners on it, and they've been fantastic. So you can check online for the theaters will come out this month, but they're doing a nice theatrical release for the film, and then it'll be available on all digital platforms.
So, and who's the distributor on this? Stars?
It's Stars Digital, yeah, who did a great job with Family Fang and for Jason Bateman, and they've been really great to work with so far.
Very, very cool. Now, I'm going to ask you both the question I always ask all my guests. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life in general?
That's good. Aaron, you want to start?
While I think he's like, while I think of something.
I honestly think that it's taken me a long, long time to really be myself, you know, and to have the confidence that what you're going to say, what you're going to try to put out in the world is interesting and important. You know, once you come to that kind of level of confidence, it really frees you up to do great stuff. But you have to have that kind of confidence. Looking at what other people are doing and trying to catch up to that is nothing. I don't know that anything great comes out of that. It's really when you dig down and try to do something that's personal and something that's that really only you could do. That's when you have an opportunity to do something great.
Brian?
I would say just not forcing issues, not forcing things. You know, it's just you can waste a lot of time and energy, whether in your personal life or in trying to make a movie, trying to kind of force issues. And better, I think what I've learned is better to, you know, obviously push as much as you can, but at a certain point, if it feels like you're pushing, just take your foot off the gas and assess the situation and kind of try a different route and kind of be practical in that way. And I think that keeps you aligned with the reality of the situation better and allows you to operate more efficiently.
Very cool. And then the last question is, what are your three favorite films of all time? Aaron. Oh, man. Because I know Brian's going to throw it to you, Aaron. So,
Exactly. I like how this is going. It's funny because Brian and I have this conversation pretty regularly. I think my all-time favorite movie is Night in the City, the original Jules Dawson film, which is – it's just the movie that I can watch. I mean, I can watch it right now, and I've seen it 100 times. And I love that – the noir period, I love that time. That's probably my favorite. And I would say maybe Mildred Pierce is second to that, they're both of them kind of have some similarities. But that noir period is probably my favorite.
I would say, and these are not off the wall answers by any means, but Long Goodbye, Network, and 8½ are, you know, kind of flawless.
Those are all very good, very very good, very very good answers, guys. So, where can people find you guys, and also find the movie when it's out?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I know you said all digital platforms, basically.
Yeah, well, it's the 30th. It comes out theatrically, and then I think shortly after that, it comes out on digital platforms, and then I think it comes to Hulu next year, and then that's that. The theater count should be out soon, so I don't know exactly what that is. And then I'm on Twitter at @A_Kaufman, and I don't know what else I'm on. I think that's.
Do you have a website, Aaron, or no?
I don't.
Gotcha. And how about you, Brian?
And me and Bob and Jason have a website that we've had for a while, thepostshow.com. And you can find some of our old sketches from our New York days there and everything. So
very cool, guys. Man, it's been an absolute pleasure, guys, having you on the show. Thank you so much for spending the time and dropping some knowledge bombs on the Indie Film Hustle Tribe.
All right. We'll speak soon.
All right. Well, guys, I hope you liked that interview. I had a ball talking to Aaron and Brian. I grilled poor Aaron about everything about Robert and his experiences with him. And I basically asked every question, any question I've ever wanted to know about Robert, I pretty much asked in this interview. So for me, it was a huge thrill and joy to talk to Aaron. And also to talk to Brian in regards to A Flock of Dudes. It sounds like a fun movie. And again, it's about that hustle, guys. You just got to keep hustling. And when the door doesn't open the way you want it to, you got to make your own door. And that's the truth, man. It is the absolute truth. And Flock of Dudes is a perfect example of that philosophy. So, guys, again, if you want to get any of the show notes, anything that we talked about, any links, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/100. And what I'm going to be doing, hopefully moving forward, is, guys, I'm going to start transcribing all of our podcasts. Since we have 100, it's going to take a while, but I'm going to be transcoding them, transcribing them, and adding them to the show notes. So if you can't listen to the podcast, you'll be able to read the podcast, because I've had a lot of requests for that. So those will be going to come slowly. They're not going to be coming up in the new ones anytime soon, but some of the older, more popular ones are going to get those first. And then slowly I'm going to be taking the entire library on and transcribing them little by little. And then we'll catch up and start with the new ones. I'll figure out the schedule. Probably won't be the day of the release of the podcast, but probably a few days later or something like that once we get a schedule in place. But that's just another thing that I'm going to be adding to the Indie Film Hustle podcast. So, guys, I cannot thank you enough for allowing me to get to the 100th episode. It's a huge mile marker for me, and I plan to get to 200 very soon, and keep growing the brand of Indie Film Hustle, keep growing what we're doing and getting the word out. And please, I hear this from a lot of the tribe members when I talk to them. They're recommending Indie Film Hustle to other people. I'm like, you got to listen to this podcast, especially podcast number 88, guys. If you guys have not listened, any of you guys listening have not listened to podcast number 88, that's at indiefilmhustle.com/088. It is by far the most talked about, the most popular podcast I've ever done. And trust me, if you have not listened to it, everyone who has listened to it will understand what I mean. it's intense. And if you need a bucket of cold water thrown on you, you need to listen to episode 88. But please spread the word, guys. I mean, seriously, please spread the word. Tell any of your filmmaking friends about us. If you find that this information is helpful to you, it'll be helpful to other people. And don't think of it as a competitive thing. There is no competition when it comes to art, guys. All right? Just try to help as many people as you can. And that's how you make it in life and definitely in this business. Because I wouldn't have been able to do as much as I've done without friends. You need friends. And if you can help other people along the way on your journey, do it. And hopefully this podcast and the website has information that can do that. So spread the word, guys. Please, retweet, post stuff that you see that we post and so on. And or just tell them, like, hey, you gotta subscribe to this. Because hopefully it'll help more people. You know, I really want to, I want this work to get out to as many people as humanly possible and help as many filmmakers as humanly possible.
Today's show is also sponsored by Enigma Elements. As filmmakers, we're always looking for ways to level up production value of our projects and speed up our workflow. This is why I created Enigma Elements, your one-stop shop for film grains, color grading LUTs, vintage analog textures like VHS and CRT images, smoke, fog textures, DaVinci Resolve presets, and much more. After working as an editor, colorist, post, and VFX supervisor for almost 30 years, I know what film creatives need to level up their projects. Check out EnigmaElements.com and use the coupon code IFH10 to get 10% off your order. I'll be adding new elements all the time. Again, that's Enigma, E-N-I-G-M-A, Elements.com.
And I found this online, which is the Farley Brothers. Wonderful a theory of life explained in 27 seconds. And basically it says, life is like going the wrong way on a moving sidewalk. If you walk, you stay put. If you stand still, you'll go backwards. And to get ahead, you have to hustle. Keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. And I'll talk to you guys soon.
Every day I'm hustling.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's INDIEFILMHUSTLE.com.